Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. So glad you're with us today. Special welcome to 94.1 FM in Hartford and 93.1 in Waterloo, 104.7 in Madison, 90.7 FM and 97.5 FM in the Twin Cities. And, of course, you can always listen to us by streaming online. You can go get our app, go to the App Store, whatever it's Apple, whatever you go to, or Android, you can find it, myfaithradio.com. And if this is the first time that you've been listening to the show, welcome. Nice to have you here. And if you've been just want some more information about us, go and get a welcome packet at myfaithradio.com. You can request your free packet if you want to. All right. Was that Elmer Fudd all of a sudden? Is that Elmer Fudd?
Or something like it.
Yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
His cousin.
Could be his cousin.
That does a morning show.
All right. As you know, I always look forward to talking to Dr. David Stevens. He's coming up next. He's written a book, co-authored it with another gentleman named Burke Jones, on servant leadership. I can't get enough of this little book. He sent me a copy of it, and I just love it. It says, Servant Leaders. It's a daily devotional, by the way. So there's a lot of entries. Servant leaders are more concerned about people than projects. The only things that will outlast you are the people you invest in. Don't you love that?
I do. It's a focus on the eternal, because nothing else that we see around us, it's only here as long as the earth is. But all the people that we invest in, that's an eternal investment.
Mm-hmm. You can have a greater effect on someone when you elect to connect with them. Have a genuine interest in finding points of mutual interest. I think that's a pretty significant comment.
What was that? I wasn't listening.
Yeah, I figured.
I'm sorry, Bill.
That's all right. You hardly ever listen to me. But
that's not true. I'm seeking to connect. I'm seeking to find those common points of interest.
As am I.
I'm very interested in this.
Yes. So Dr. David Stevens, we're going to get him on the studio line in just a minute. And then Dr. Everett Piper is going to be with us. Excited about him as well. He's the president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University. He wrote a op-ed called This Is Not a Daycare, and that went viral, and he's turned it into a book. And it's really, the book is a call to higher standard, a standard of absolute truth found in the person of Christ and the authority of Scripture. So that's what we have to look forward to today in this hour. It's 7 minutes after. Be back in just a minute with Dr. David Stevens. Good morning. It's 8 minutes after the hour. Bill Arnold here, sitting in today for Bill Arnold. So nice that you're with us today. You know, a lot of people talk about having white coat syndrome, which means they get nervous when they go to the doctor. And I have the opposite of white coat syndrome when I get to talk to Dr. David Stevens. I get pure excitement because he's always such a delight to talk to. He's on the studio line. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Bill. I'm glad you don't have that syndrome. Your blood pressure would be going up.
That's a very serious condition, isn't it?
It is. And obviously, when people come in, you're just screening their blood pressure. You think, oh, my goodness, they're high. And then we know to have them try it at home and do it with their own cuff. And you find out, well, it's just white coat. They were just scared about being here and push their blood pressure up a bit and nothing to be concerned about.
Does it also elevate if I come in and I'm nervous, and does my cortisol shoot up a little bit? And would that change my blood sugar as well?
It could, and your catecholamines and your cortisol both could go up. Your adrenals just kind of give a squeeze. It's that flight or fright response that God gave us. And when you're afraid of something, those things happen. It's preparing you to run or fight, essentially, if something bad is happening. So yeah, it can cause problems, and especially children you see this with, of course, because they're terrified of going to the doctor. No matter how many times you reassure them, they know that's where they got their shots. They're concerned they're going to get another one. So,
yeah. And is that something that doctors feel much responsibility for their own bedside manner or their office manner in terms of just being calming, or is that something that's just kind of out of their control?
No, you really need to be focused on that because you can give better care and the person's more receptive. If they've got that fear in them, they're not going to hear what you're saying. They're not going to be thinking and answering questions properly. And so bedside manner is extremely important. In fact, people are more concerned that you can care than you can cure.
Wow.
I mean, they'll leave you for a doctor who really shows care for them and personal interest and concern. And, of course, Christian doctors, I think, can have an edge in that area because they love their patients because God loves them.
Yeah.
And they're there to serve as servant leaders, as you were talking about. So, yeah, bedside manner is extremely important, and there's a lot of healing that takes place just through the fact of how you interact with the patient.
Mm-hmm. David, what is it called when the doctor is going to, basically put his hand on the doorknob to leave the room, and that's when the person always comes out with the most important and critical question? Is that something you can coach us to get to sooner?
Yeah, it's that one more thing. Oh, doctor, excuse me, just one more thing. You're about halfway out the door.
Yeah.
You can be trained, and we train people how to deal with that and with some directive questioning. And what is your greatest concern today?
Okay.
People come in complaining about things, and often you can get accused of that because they seem very concerned, but they're coming in with rather innocuous complaint. I've got a little cold, and you're thinking, did they come all the way in here to see me today just because it's a little cold? Is there something else behind there that they're concerned about? And so you can kind of probe a little bit. And when you do this day in and day out, hours with patients, you get pretty sensitized to sensing things like that and probing in and trying to get to the bigger issue. And it's very important because the thing they're not talking about till you're ready to leave the door, or sometimes they never get enough nerve to bring up, is the most important thing. So you really want to try to find that out and help them.
Yeah. All right. If we can talk a little bit about this ongoing opioid crisis and the number of the people that are dying from it. It's just staggering.
It is 33,000
wow.
people in 2015, about 90 Americans a day die from overdoses or other complications. And it's an epidemic. That's what the National Institute of Health is calling it. And we're very concerned about it in medicine, and we're complicit in some of it. In the late 90s, a lot of pharmaceutical companies came out with new opioids, narcotics, that were designer, and they, the thing was, well, these aren't really addictive. Well, it turned out they were, and a lot of people got hooked on them. And what's happening is people misuse even opioid drugs that you give them for, they've had surgery or major dental procedure or something like that. So opioids are dangerous. There's a lot of things happening, Bill, in the healthcare profession. I know here where I'm located, we have to have special education on opioids, narcotics. If we write any kind of narcotic, we have to put it on a central registry now in the whole state. And so I can look, because what people do that are addicted will come and doctor shop. So if they
yes.
can't get it here, they'll go over to another doctor. Well, now I can go on to databases. I'm getting ready to write a prescription and see if they've gotten it, if they've gotten it filled, if they've gone to multiple pharmacies, multiple doctors, all sorts of things trying to control this epidemic. And then doctors are getting better training on, giving limited amounts, not being fooled. I lost my prescription, all the things that people do trying to get more of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a huge problem. And then with young people, it's mainly heroin, and it's cheaper, and oftentimes they'll get hooked by getting in the medicine cabinet and getting some old pills from somebody's previous surgery and start using them, and then it's hard to get more of them, and so they get on heroin, which is cheaper and sometimes is actually laced with fentanyl. Fentanyl's a
wow.
synthetic narcotic that's 100 times more potent, and end up overdosing on that.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Stevens, what about the insurance industry? Are they dictating outcomes where the insurance industry might say, well, we can't pay to have you get a back surgery, but we can give you some opioids to deal with the pain?
Yeah, I don't think they'd be that blunt about it, but sometimes, you know, chronic pain is a very difficult thing to deal with. And what we're doing more and more is referring people to special pain clinics with doctors who do this all day, especially if there's long-term chronic pain or if they have gotten hooked on opioids. Then getting them good treatment and recognizing it early. There's some good drugs to help get people off. I know you were involved in this area in the recovery bill mm-hmm. with people and counseling and all the rest of it, but recognizing this drug-seeking behavior and doing something about it, not just saying, sorry, I'm not going to give you the narcotics, which you have to do, but really dealing with the issue and getting the people, the person and the young person or middle-aged. A lot of middle-aged and older people are getting addicted, getting them into a treatment program where they can actually get some help and get this resolved.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Stevens, I'd like to ask you about cognition-enhancing drugs. I'm going to go to a break first. On the surface, that doesn't sound like a horribly bad thing, as I'm drinking my coffee this morning. I'm not sure that counts.
I've already had my cup of tea.
I'm not sure that counts, but I do want to get your understanding of cognition-enhancing drugs when we return. It's 16 minutes after the hour. I'm talking to Dr. David Stevens from the Christian Medical and Dental Association. Be right back. It's 18 minutes after the hour. I'm speaking to Dr. David Stevens from Christian Medical and Dental Association. Dr. Stevens, I want to learn what I can about cognition-enhancing drugs. What are they? And how do I get some?
Well, you know, you mentioned you're drinking your cup of coffee and I'm drinking tea, and we do that because what? They have a little caffeine in it or soda or something, kind of wake us up. Perk you up a little bit. There are certain drugs that do that, but to a greater extent. Ritalin, for example, that we give for attention deficit disorder in kids is an amphetamine, and it'll wake you up. And what is happening is that some of these drugs, another one called modafinil, is a drug that can actually used by the military in with soldiers and fighter pilots and stuff that are, you know, needing to be in combat and that type of thing. And they enhance performance. You think quicker. You mm-hmm. have a better mood. But the trouble of this stuff is that now it is beginning to spill out and being used to help me do well on this exam. Or I'm a physician and I've taken night call and I'm really tired today. Let me take a little something this morning, not a cup of coffee, but something a little more potent to help me think better as I work. And this is getting on campuses and universities, and kids are using it for, you know, I'll do better on the exam. It's become a pretty big issue. In Germany, for example, they did a survey and 20% of the surgeons admitted to have taking some sort of cognitive enhancing drug because of all the night call and stuff they were doing. At University of Maryland, two-thirds of the students had been offered something and one-third of them had used them. So these things really got onto campuses where students and others are using them. So what's the problem? Well, one of the things, these have been pretty well studied in dealing with certain diseases. You know, the second drug I mentioned is actually used for narcolepsy and sleep apnea and other things. But they have not been studied on, let's just take them recreationally to help me improve my performance. And the Federal Drug Administration will not allow studies in normal patients. They're saying, what are we treating? We're not going to let you do a study to see what the side effects are and problems are with using this drug if you do not have a disease. And then secondly, they give an unfair advantage. I mean, you know, somebody sitting next to me is going to do better on the exam because he's on something. Is that fair? And not only the health benefits for that or health problems for that person, but also you know, the enhanced and unenhanced thinkers. Are we going to drive everybody into doing this? So growing concern, and because we're just seeing so much of this going on.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Stevens, is there kind of a flawed process when I think of doctors in residency and they're asked to do, 28-hour shifts? And I'm thinking, is that a flawed program?
Well, that's changed tremendously, though still issues. I mean, used to be no limits on what they could do to you as an intern. You know the word intern, we don't use it as much anymore, but the reason it was used for your first year after medical school is you had to live in the hospital and be available 24 hours a day. You were interned in the hospital, and you weren't allowed to be married. You weren't allowed to be married. You get thrown out of the program if you got married during the – and now we call it residency, which has the same connotation. I'm a resident. I live here in the hospital. It's not that bad. They've limited the amount of time you're allowed to work to about 80 hours a week and how long shifts can be and all sorts of things. And they've got this tension. Let me explain why. The tension is you don't want to kill your interns, and it can affect performance and treatment and all the rest of it and your ability to think. But the other side of the coin is if you don't have enough time with a patient going through a disease process, let's say somebody with diabetes that goes into ketoacidosis. Let me explain it this way. If you walked into a movie theater in the middle of the movie, how much would you understand of what was going on? You have to see the whole movie to understand it, and you have to see the whole progression of the disease at some point to really understand where you are. If you've been to the movie before, you walk in the middle, and you know exactly where it is. And it's the same in medicine. So you have to have these longer times with patients to really understand the course of the disease. Which is important, but you at the other end of it is that you can keep people there so long and so hard that it's so hard and they're getting so little sleep that it's dangerous for patients and dangerous for them. So there's a lot of work going on trying to find that balance of what is enough time without really impinging the performance of those in training or doctors in practice.
Yeah, Dr. Stevens, I just have a little bit of time left, but I'd like to take our remaining 90 seconds to ask you about gene editing. We had a really thoughtful response from a listener who was talking about God can use gene editing for good as well. And sometimes as Christians, we have a tendency of overreacting and freaking out to new technologies and treatments. But gene editing can also go in and help do some really good things.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, we talked about this a couple weeks ago and talked about it was wrong to take embryos and gene edit and destroy them and, you know, do experiments and kill human beings. And someone wrote in and said, well, you know, I have a child with this genetic disease and what about gene editing to solve that problem? Now, there's a difference in doing this, obviously risk in any type of new treatment, but gene editing in someone who can give permission and it's there to treat a disease is permissible. You give informed consent like you do for anything in medicine, understanding the risk and the benefits. And this is a risky type thing, but better technology now is making it less risky. And I pray to this family, they're going to find what they need. They've had two or three children with genetic diseases that the NIH is working on. And if you're not destroying human beings on the altar of science to get a cure, and you have informed consent, yes. And gene editing can be done in children and adults, and we're working towards those end and maybe able to solve a lot of diseases, and that would be wonderful. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Stevens, thank you so much for being on the program. I so look forward to having you on the show, and I'll talk to you hopefully again in a couple of weeks.
God bless, Bill.
All right. Thanks so much. 25 minutes after the hour, we'll take a short break and be back in just a minute.
When I wake up in the morning, love, the sunlight hurts my eyes.
It is half past the hour. So glad you're with us today. We're going to take a little break for news, and then we've got Dr. Everett Piper, president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University. We're going to talk about his book, Not a Daycare. Be back in just a minute. Twenty-five minutes until the top of the hour. Being the fragrance of Christ means communicating well with others. Sharon Sampson says one of the best ways to do this is to share stories and offer invitations.
I think it's just very easy for us to get stuck in our own heads and recount facts, and that we need to communicate in a way that leaves space for people to be part of it, as opposed to communicating in a way that starts and ends with us. And that is really what a story has the power to do, to create space for people to be a character, to be a partner in what you're communicating. So it's the difference of a leader of an organization getting up or an annual report reporting that simply says, this is what we do, period, the end. As opposed to communicating in a way that says, this is what we're going after, and this is what we invite you to be part of, and this is what we can do together. Like, that is a shared story that I can come and be part of. I can come be a co-creator in that story. I can be a stakeholder in that story, as opposed to just observe you doing what you do, you living out your sort of calling and conviction. But if you don't communicate it to me in a way that leaves space and invites me to be part of it, then nothing shifts.
Oh, that's just good stuff. That's Sharon Sampson, CEO and founder of Team Open Book. You can go hear that entire interview at myfaithradio.com. Type in Sharon Sampson or Core Values. We'll take a short break, and then Dr. Everett Piper is going to be with us. Can't wait. Be back in a minute. Good morning and welcome to the show. I have on our studio line Dr. Everett Piper. He is the president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University. He's the author of Why I Am a Liberal and Other Conservative Ideas, and the viral op-ed, This Is Not a Daycare, which has become a book. And we're going to talk to him today about that. Good morning, Dr. Piper.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. I will on occasion also put in the name Dr. Everett Piper. As you know, in this neck of the woods, there's another Dr. Piper that you're competing with.
Yeah, and I've been asked many times if I'm related, but I think the answer is no, and that's unfortunate, I guess, at my end.
Well, he's a great guy. So your book, Not a Daycare, I really started as a viral op-ed. And as I start reading the book, which, by the way, is great, I'm stunned by this story of this student who is offended that you are preaching a sermon on love because he is not
exactly
showing love himself. So that has become a trigger point and has made him uncomfortable.
That's exactly where this whole story started. It was 2 years ago. It was Thanksgiving weekend. We had a required chapel here at Oklahoma Wesleyan University, as we do every week. This particular chapel service, the speaker spoke on 1 Corinthians 13. It was a homily on love. There was no sarcasm, no political humor. It was a pure and simple homily on 1 Corinthians 13, the quintessential love chapter of the Bible. Well, afterward, the kid comes forward, confronts the speaker, and says, you offended me today. You singled me out, and you singled my peers out. Apparently, the kid thought we were supposed to issue a trigger warning before an altar call. Apparently, he thought 1 Corinthians was a microaggression. So the kid felt guilty for not being loving enough, I guess, and therefore he confronts us and says, you shouldn't have done it. I was incredulous. I wrote an article. I titled it, This is a University, It's Not a Daycare. And I basically said, if you expect me to coddle you and comfort you rather than confront you and ask you to become a man of character rather than somebody who's selfish enough to point the finger at everybody else rather than looking internally and seeking how he can correct, how he can confess, how he can be contrite, then you're in the wrong place. You might want to go someplace else. And I concluded by saying, my goodness, this is a university. It's not a daycare. I expect you to grow up. That led to this book.
Dr. Piper, who leads this kid across the street?
It's exactly it. I mean, today we've got a participation trophy culture where you expect to be patted on the head and given a trophy every time you just enter a room and show up, mm-hmm. rather than be challenged and pushed and molded and confronted into being a person that actually matures and becomes an adult worthy of being listened to and worthy of following if you're a leader. We have created a nation of snowflakes. And that's what we see in these campus rebellions right now.
Okay, if I'm growing up in this age where I get a participation trophy for everything I do, I mean, our baseball team goes 0-13 and we get a participation trophy, and I actually get into the workplace and I go to my first meeting and I suggest an idea that the other people don't like and I collapse, there's probably a good reason for that.
Absolutely. I like to hearken back to 1948, Richard Weaver's seminal work. It was titled Ideas Have Consequences. And what was his point? Ideas have consequences. They matter. And when you teach self-absorption and narcissism for 30, 40, 50 years like we have in our classrooms, those ideas, those chickens will come home to roost in our culture, in our courts, and in our country. And that's what we see right now. Bad ideas, bad behavior, bad government, bad kids, and we see bad culture. Good ideas will produce the opposite. And why is 1948 important in Weaver's work? He's looking back just a few short years earlier to World War II, to Hitler, who said, "Let me control the textbooks and I will control the state." Weaver recognized that it was as predictable as the sunrise. This terrible situation of Nazi socialism was predictable because of the ideas that culture was consuming. And he confronted it and said, the only way you can confront ideological cancer is stop consuming the carcinogens, the ideological carcinogens in this first place. Ideas matter.
I feel like I'm talking to a university president here.
Well, sorry. No, I apologize.
No, you're just so unbelievably smart. You know, I'm going to jump all over the book, if you don't mind, because you've got me on a train of thought right now where if you don't allow kids as they're growing up to fully understand what the consequences are, I think it takes them longer and longer to grow up. So when you reach college and you're being triggered by at a Christian college about a sermon on love, there's something seriously wrong. Now, you mentioned in your book your dear sweet nephew who had a little trouble with drugs and alcohol and got off on the wrong foot for a while, and he needed to hit bottom. In other words, he needed to be in a situation where he needed to face his consequences, and that was what was going to help him grow up. And I think today we're so quick to help our kids out of their difficult circumstances that they are not living out the consequences themselves. Fair?
Spot on. We have forgotten the age-old athletic axiom, no pain, no gain.
Yes.
We ignore scripture where we're told the Lord disciplines those he loves, and as iron sharpens iron, let one man sharpen another. And for such a time as this, what others intend for evil, God will reclaim, redeem for good. All of these verses and all of these axioms, I would argue, say the same thing. And that is where there's dissonance and there's tension and there's pain and there's conflict, those are the opportunities where you can sharpen yourself and grow. Without that, you will be nothing but soft and lazy and fat and sassy, sitting in your lazy boy, criticizing everybody else, but you're really not an athlete. You really can't engage in the game yourself because you haven't committed yourself to the routine, the rigor of working out and experiencing the tension in life.
Oh, are you ever my kind of guy? All right. Now, in your book, Not a Daycare, you talk about the prodigal university. Would you explain that?
Our universities are a mess. This whole conversation that you and I are having right now is my fault. And when I say my fault, I don't mean me personally. It's my industry's fault. It's education's fault. It's the industry of higher education that has created this monster. And it's Christian universities, too. Christian universities, this is my advice to the listeners right now, don't trust the four-color brochure. Go in and make sure that the institution you're thinking to send your kids to is truly and boldly and unapologetically committed to the inerrancy of the word and the objectivity of truth. And if it's not, don't waste your money. Why in the world would you want to send your kid off to an institution that doesn't stand for the truth of Christ and the truth of Scripture? Why would you settle for anything less? But unfortunately, the American Academy, secular and quote-unquote sacred alike, is a prodigal right now. We've abandoned our heritage of objective truth and the inerrancy of the word, and we're wandering off, spending our heritage, spending our inheritance, wallowing around in the pig slop of postmodernity, and it's high time that we come home to the truth of Christ and truth of Scripture. I would argue if we don't, we've lost our freedom, we've lost our way, and we're going to continue to suffer accordingly.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Piper, there's been a lot of commentary on safe spaces and campus riots, and we're seeing more and more of that. What is your take on all that?
It's nonsense. It's nonsense. I'll quote C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis tells us in the Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, to be more specific, that the great lion Aslan is not safe, but he's good.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me paraphrase that. The great lion of the liberal arts, the great lion of the academy, of the college and university, the great lion of the ivory tower, the great lion of the church is not supposed to be safe, but it's supposed to be good. There's a huge difference between safe education and good education. I don't want the first. I want the second.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Piper, I still have a big bag of questions with your name on it. I'd like to take a little break and come back and continue our conversation. I'm talking to Dr. Everett Piper. He is the author of a book called Not a Daycare. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. We've got Dr. Everett Piper on the studio line this morning. We're talking about his book, Not a Daycare. And Dr. Piper, you talk about the intolerance of the left. Why do you think the left has made such an effort to take over academia and culture?
Well, I think they recognize you control culture not by bullets and bombs as much as you do by books and blogs, by ideas. Ideas have consequences. Go back to the evil of Hitler. He recognized, let me control the textbooks and I will control the state. At the same time, Huxley and Orwell were writing of dystopias where education would be used as a means of total power and total control to control the populace. So we know historically that ideas matter, words matter, definitions matter. You could even look to the way Jesus describes himself, the Alpha and the Omega, the Word made flesh and dwelling among us. It's because he is the Word and words matter. He defines himself as an alphabet. There's a reason for this. So what we see in culture right now is the left recognizing this, and apparently the church, the right, the conservative, has forgotten this. It's time we start remembering that as a conservative, I am obligated to conserve things. And the most important conservation that I can engage in is the conservation of God's time-tested truths that are revealed to us by God, not constructed by you or me.
Mm. You also have been an outspoken critic of protecting free speech rights. So what can leaders in college education do to encourage diversity of thought and still handle the pushback that they're going to get from students as well?
Well, we need to call out this ideological fascism that's prevailing on all of our campuses right now as opposed to intellectual freedom. You know, Berkeley fancies itself as the birthplace of the free speech movement.
Yeah.
Nonsense. You can't speak freely at Berkeley right now, and we've seen it in the news. Berkeley isn't the birthplace of free speech. Bethlehem is.
Right.
It's Jesus that said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." So the first thing we need to do is call out the duplicity and the hypocrisy of those who claim to be tolerant. You ask them a question like this: can you tolerate my intolerance? Do you hate hateful people? Are you sure nothing is sure? Do you know that nothing can be known? These people are duplicitous at every turn. It's self-refuting. They know it. It's like watching a dog chase its tail. We need to do like Jesus did. Ask the rhetorical question and just be quiet and let their worldview implode because they can't answer us logically, consistently, and coherently. Jesus gives us the freedom to debate. He gives us the freedom to be wrong, but we recognize, if we truly want freedom, that we have to subscribe to what Chesterton told us. Get rid of big laws, you don't get liberty, but rather thousands of little laws that rush in to fill the vacuum. And he also said, if you want freedom, build a fence. Freedom does not suppose a free-for-all. Freedom can only be had within the boundaries of truth, i.e. the fence that God gives us to enjoy the debate.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Piper, what is a classic liberal education? And what are the characteristics of it?
Well, in my first book, I titled it Why I'm a Liberal and Other Conservative Ideas. Well, what was I doing? I'm basically poking a stick in the eye of the progressive left, and I'm saying I'm more classically liberal, if you will, than my left-of-center counterpart because I believe in liberty and liberation and freedom and an open argument, a robust exchange of ideas. This was the birthplace of the liberal arts education. It was the birth idea, if you will. You go back to Oxford 1,000 years ago. What was the point? To educate a free man, a free society, a free woman, a free culture, to educate in liberty and liberation. Thus the word liberal. I'm more classically liberal today than many of those listening that disagree with me because I am free to debate and argue and have an open exchange of ideas because truth will judge the debate. It will be the referee, not power, not privilege, not the pulpit, not the podium, but truth will be the judge of who's right and who's wrong.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'm going to give you a 7-10 split here. If truth is the necessary ingredient, how are we going to effectively, or how do we effectively define truth to a world that has completely rejected it out of hand?
Well, I'm going to use Jesus as the model here.
Please do.
I think Jesus confronted the exact same nonsense in his day. He had a bunch of pundits and politicians and professors, if you will. They were called Pharisees, and they constantly harangued him and challenged him. Now, the smartest guy that ever walked the face of the earth, he's the Word made flesh, he's God incarnate, he knew the answer, he could win the debate. But why did he almost never argue? Maybe he was on to something. Maybe we ought to follow in his shoes. He always asked the rhetorical question, and then he was quiet. Whose face is on this coin? Why do you call me Lord? Do you want to pick up the first stone? Are you without sin? And then the smartest man ever in the history of humanity, God made flesh among us, is quiet, and he lets the worldview of his opponents implode. Maybe that's the way we confront this nonsense today, rather than thinking that we have to argue all the time. A good rhetorical question is as powerful as anything.
Mm-hmm. I got a couple questions left in just a couple minutes. Let me ask you, what would you say to families that are a little bit nervous about sending their kids to colleges because of the liberal slant or reputation they might have?
Stop sending your kids off to these institutions that teach this pablum. I mean, seriously, you spend 18 years of your life training up your child in the way he should go, and then in the first 18 minutes as you drive away from new student orientation, that school is taking pride in tearing his heart, mind, and soul out. Why do you do this? People need to vote with their pocketbook and vote with their feet. They need to stop spending this money on institutions that pride themselves on tearing your kid apart. 70% of your kids will abandon their faith by the time they're juniors if you don't pay attention to what I'm saying.
Wow, that's unbelievable. All right, what's a thing or two you would hope that readers will take away from your book, Not a Daycare?
Ideas matter. You, whether you're sending your kid to school or not, it doesn't make any difference. If you're a grandparent that doesn't, you don't think you care about this anymore, you should, because the ideas that are taught today in our classrooms will be practiced tomorrow in our culture, and it will impact everything from your freedom to engage in the practice of your own religion to your own stock portfolio. Because when people are taught to lie on their accounting, you have WorldCom and Enron and these stories, because companies are imploding because of the lack of integrity. Ideas matter.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Piper, I had Dr. Carol Swain on the program this week, and she said that she will not miss what American universities have allowed themselves to become. It's become very sad, hasn't it?
It is. There was a day when universities across the nation, across the world, had this above the library entrance: "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." We were grounded in a Judeo-Christian ethic. Mm-hmm. Harvard was founded to lay Christ at the bottom as the foundation for all learning.
That's at their charter, isn't it?
We've left our way. We need to return.
Yeah, that's at the charter of Harvard, isn't it? To know Christ.
Absolutely.
And make him known. Of course, that's been...
Yes.
Is that still around? Have they gotten rid of that?
Oh, they've abandoned it. They were. John Harvard would roll over in his grave.
Oh, no doubt.
To know what they're teaching today. There is a handful, and it's literally only a handful of institutions left that actually believe that God defines life, you don't, that truth is given by God, not made up by you or me, and that the Bible is the revealed truth that helps us understand. It's the measuring rod outside of those things being measured that allows us to do the measuring, to quote C.S. Lewis.
Dr. Piper, I know you're a busy man. Thank you so much for taking time to be on the show. And the book is Not a Daycare by Dr. Everett Piper. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you. Blessings.
Yes. Bye-bye. We'll take a short break and be back with more of the show in just a minute. I would say Dr. Piper kind of uses the direct approach, wouldn't you, Rebecca?
Yes, and he's good at it.
He's very good at it. And boy, we've gotten a great response already. I've got a listener listening on an app in Nebraska named Jim who said, great interview.
So, I agree, Jim.
Yeah,
I thought it was good.
Thanks so much. Yeah. So that wraps up our show. So thanks so much for listening. We just really had a great time today. Just the second hour alone with Dr. David Stevens, Dr. Everett Piper. And then in the first hour, we had Jared Stepman on. Really nice to have him come on board. And then Jeremy Keaton. So we've just had a great program. If you want to go back and access any of the programs, they should be podcastable in the next couple hours. I'm not sure that's a word, but I'm going to make it one starting today. That wraps up our show. See you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show. Connecting.